approach, which is the state of the tenth of the other body, the Senate. So we've asked Attorney General Burns and his assistant attorney generals to join us today and discuss some of the issues. But before we do, while you're walking up and taking place, we have here in Anchorage, we have Representative Costello, Representative Edgman, Representative Jewell, Representative Guerra, Vice Chair Fairclough, and Stoltz. And if folks from Juneau, from the Finance Committee that are there, can you just shout your name out so we know you're on the record?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have Representative Dugan, and this is Representative Wilson, and we are excited for this afternoon's agenda.
I'm glad somebody is. Thank you, Representative Wilson, for moderating there. We are very pleased that you were able to make it here today, Attorney General Burns. Before you start, why don't you introduce the associates that are there with you, and then introduce yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To my left is Brian Bjornquist.
And keep your mic so you can...
Sorry. To my left is Brian Bjornquist, and to my right, Chris Pogue, both of whom are with the Department of Law and both of whom have been very instrumental in the analysis of the language that we will discuss today.
Okay. And go ahead and introduce yourself and any opening comments, and take as much time as you need, Mr. Attorney General.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As always, it is a pleasure to appear before the committee, and I say that with all sincerity. My name is John Burns, and I serve as the Attorney General for the state of Alaska. My understanding is that the House Finance Committee, in inviting me before it today, has requested an explanation as to why the Department of Law feels, as we do, that the contingency and non-severability language that appears in the current version of the Senate Finance Committee's proposed but not yet transmitted or finalized capital budget is unconstitutional. At the outset, I think it important to note that until such time as the Senate actually transmits a capital budget to the House for review, any discussion as to the unconstitutionality of anticipated language is purely speculative, since it is possible that the Senate Finance Committee will reconsider and itself remove the problematic language in the interest both of avoiding litigation and also to ensure that the various energy projects are not all jeopardized. My responsibility as Attorney General, and in fact the responsibility of all public officials, whether elected or appointed, is to uphold the Constitution. Politics must always yield to the constitutional principles that govern the administration of this great state. The principles of our democratic form of government are grounded in the Constitution, and it is the Constitution that governs resolution of the issue on which the capital budget seems to have floundered in Senate finance. The injection of contingency and non-severability language that is clearly intended to constrain the constitutional power of the executive branch. The Alaska Constitution, and I apologize if I'm reverting to the Civics 101 lesson, the Alaska Constitution establishes an appropriation process that consists of four steps. First, the governor is required to submit a budget to the legislature for consideration. Second, the legislature has the power to pass appropriation bills. Third, the governor has line item veto authority over those appropriation items. And fourth, the legislature is vested and empowered with the authority to override the governor's veto. This is the process that has been in place since nearly statehood, and it is the foundation of the checks and balances that constrain the exercise of power between the two co-equal branches of government. Sections 36 and 37 of the Senate Finance version of the capital budget, however, disrupts this well-established process and upsets the delicate balance of powers set forth in the Alaska Constitution. The simple reality is that the contingency and non-severability provisions in Sections 36 and 37 are unconstitutional for the reasons that I will explain. Section 36, which is which I refer to as the linkage clause, seeks to link together approximately 105 separate and distinct projects, comprising an estimated $404 million in total spending, and requires the enactment of all or none of those projects without reduction. This condition is unconstitutional and unenforceable because it deprives the governor of his constitutional authority to review, reduce, or strike individual appropriation items. Alaska's Constitutional Convention delegates intended to create a strong executive branch with a strong control on the purse strings of the state. The Constitution provides the governor this control in part by granting the governor the line item veto authority to strike or reduce items in appropriation bills. It was both logical and prudent for the constitutional delegates to confer this power on the governor, since the governor's position is uniquely different in that the governor is a statewide elected official, whereas each legislator is elected from a specified district. Because the governor has a statewide constituency base, it was prudent to give the governor authority to strike or reduce individual appropriation items and to act as a constraint on excessive spending. Nonetheless, as you all know, the final power rests with the legislature to override a governor's veto. The line item veto power has been described by constitutional scholar Richard Briffelt as, and I quote, the coming together of three widespread state constitutional policies. One, the rejection of legislative log rolling. Two, the imposition of fiscal restrictions on the legislature. And three, the strengthening of the governor's role in budgetary matters. Coincidentally, Professor Briffelt was quoted extensively by the Alaska Supreme Court in Legislative Council v. Knowles. The power and authority to appropriate funds are vested in the legislature. Nonetheless, the governor plays a vital role in the appropriation process. The governor's authority to propose a budget and his power to strike or reduce appropriation items are significant and essential to the appropriation process. Attempts by either branch to disrupt this process violates the balance of power that has been so carefully crafted in the Constitution. Section 36 violates the governor's constitutional power by linking the appropriation for each energy project to the passage and enactment of every appropriation made in Section 4 without reduction. This process of linking usurps the governor's line item veto power and, as I noted earlier, sets the checks and balances that constrains those two branches of government. Think about it logically. If the legislature could link one appropriation to another, or in this case, 150 different projects, the legislature could effectively eliminate the governor's power to strike or reduce individual line items. The governor would have only two choices, reject them all or accept them all as a group. Allowing the linkage of appropriations with such contingency language eviscerates the line item veto authority vested in the governor and would enable the legislature to circumvent the governor's constitutional authority. Section 37 exacerbates this constitutional violation by, in essence, doubling the constitutional linkage of these various energy projects. Through the inclusion of what's been called the non-severability language, the legislature attempts to achieve the same result through a different means. As drafted, Section 37 provides that if the contingency language of 36 is held to be invalid, all the appropriation items in Section 4 become invalid as well. What the Senate has sought to craft is a bill that is an all or a nothing bill. The contingency and non-severability provisions are inherently harmful to the appropriation process. As drafted, even if the governor were to choose not to line item veto any appropriation that's been made in Section 4, each appropriation would still be subject to legal challenge because of the non-severability provision in Section 37. Any litigant opposed to even a single project could effectively invalidate every appropriation by successfully challenging Section 36. This litigation risk that I've just talked about places a cloud over every appropriation and could in turn impair the development of any single project. Section 36 and 37 potentially jeopardize the funding for these energy projects until such time as the Supreme Court rules on the validity and severability of these two sections. Until that time, no project could rely upon actually receiving the money that was appropriated in Section 4. It would be difficult for project proponents to contract and to develop the energy projects when state funding is uncertain. Moreover, contract damages may potentially be at risk where projects for which appropriated money has been, or money has been appropriated, that appropriation is held to be invalid. It would also be difficult or impossible for a project to obtain financing, since any lender or bond issuer would first require that all project funding be secured before additional financing would be available at reasonable interest rates. These are legal risks that arise solely as a result of the Senate Finance Committee's attempt to usurp the governor's constitutional power to exercise line item veto authority. To avoid the harm to the appropriation process, the Senate Finance Committee should eliminate the two provisions from the capital budget. By eliminating these provisions, the legislature would still retain ultimate control over the funding of these various projects, since, as is clearly provided in the Constitution, if the governor were to line item veto any project in the appropriation bill, the legislature retains the constitutional power that is vested to it in Article 2, Section 16 to override that veto. At a minimum, I would strongly encourage the Senate Finance Committee to remove the non-severability provision contained in Section 37 of the Capitol bill. If the legislature, if Senate Finance removes Section 37, the non-vetoed appropriation items could still move forward with certainty while any vetoed projects awaited a court decision on the constitutionality of Section 36 to the extent that the legislature desired to press the issue to litigation. Aside from violating Article 2, Section 15, the contingency provision is also unconstitutional under what we call the confinement clause, which is found in Article 2, Section 13. The confinement clause provides, in essence, that appropriation bills shall be confined to appropriations. The analysis involves a five-part assessment, which is commonly referred to as the Hammond test. It was first set up in the legislative legal versus Hammond, and then further articulated and developed in the legislegal versus Knowles. Succinctly stated, the contingency provision and the intent language inserted by the Senate Finance Committee in Senate Bill 46 fail the five-part Hammond test. First, AS 4499-115, which is the energy policy, does not mandate that the energy policy be implemented by linking every project or every appropriation. Instead, 115 specifically encourages state agencies to work with individual communities to identify and develop cost-effective sources of energy. Second, because linking appropriations is not provided for in 115, doing so in these provisions effectively amends existing law and is beyond the requirement of minimum necessary to explain how the money is to be spent. Another one of the Hammond tests. Third, because linking appropriations is a direct attempt to control how monies are spent on various energy projects, it attempts to administer the appropriation of expenditures. And finally, by linking appropriations that bear no direct relationship to one another, that is not a condition that is deemed germane for the purpose of the appropriation. And again, it bears noting that although the Senate Finance Committee contends that its goal is to advocate and advance the energy policy found in 115, by linking energy projects with the non-severability provision, the Senate Finance Committee has actually placed a cloud of uncertainty over these appropriations, discouraging rather than encouraging the achievement of the goals found in the statute. I remain hopeful that after further review of the contingency and non-severability language, that it will be removed from any capital budget that is ultimately forwarded to the House, and that the capital budget, like all appropriations, can be evaluated consistent with the powers and the authority conferred by the Constitution on the legislature and the executive branch. This time, Mr. Chairman, I would open myself and my associates to questions from the committee.
I think Representative Garrow had the first question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Burns, I might surprise you and other members that I'm not going to argue the constitutionality. The legislature's attorneys have taken a slightly different opinion than yours, and frankly, I don't know who's right. But I agree with you that that we need to find a way to get the contingency language out of the bill. And you and I had a good conversation on the street the other day, and I just want to share that with folks, and I think that it might provide us a way out of the special session, which is what I think the public wants. You know, the Senate had their reasons for putting the veto language in, and we've talked about that before, and we'll just disagree about that. The only way I see to get out of the special session is the Senate wants certain energy projects. I don't know what portion of that list they want. I don't know what portion they're wedded to. There are members of the House that have different priorities. They support maybe some of those projects, maybe not some of them. Maybe they need more information on some of them. And the governor, a third of the projects inside that clause were the governor's, two-thirds were the Senate's. But here's where we are. Unless the governor and the Senate and the House agree to a set of energy projects and work together to do that, we're never going to end the special session. And we talked about that, and I thought you might have a great role in maybe helping mediate that with the parties, that if you could sit down with the governor and the members of both bodies, we could agree to projects that benefit the people of the state, lower the cost of energy, are good investments. When the Senate hears that maybe you agree with a certain number of the projects in here, maybe we all agree and they agree to take out the contingency language. And I'm wondering if you would maybe, would you agree if the governor sort of allowed you to play that role, would you agree to sort of help play that role? I mean, I know as a lawyer you've mediated cases probably at least informally. You've negotiated cases informally. People never get everything they want in lawsuits, right? You get something somewhere that's not on neither extreme. So I guess would you take that role if the governor asked you to, which is to try and find a list of projects we can all agree on, because otherwise I don't see a way out of the special session.
For the chair,
Attorney General Burns.
For the chair, Representative Garrett, it's always a pleasure to have the opportunity to talk with you or any member of the legislature. And I've been very privileged to spend time, quality time, with virtually all 60. I serve as Attorney General. I serve the state of Alaska in whatever capacity I can be of assistance. I'm always prepared to do so. Nonetheless, we need to be very careful relative to the constitutional structures that are provided in the Constitution, because I'm simply referencing the Constitution and the process itself. Well, the process is about a public transmittal of a capital budget from one to the other for review and finally a veto process. What I would be very loath and reluctant to see happen is that process be corrupted and decisions be made behind the door, closed doors, so that appropriate vetting and analysis gets corrupted. So, I think our founders, in our Constitution, they did it right. I mean, they had the benefit of seeing the problems of so many other states, and what they did was to try to take the best of all and to create a process that really allows projects to be
to be vetted and decisions to be made, hopefully in the best interest always of the state. And I'm reluctant to see deals cut behind closed doors in the interest of simply saving time.
I just want to just throw one thing. The Attorney General used the term veto process. The first time I worked on a bill, I used that term, even when they were planning to sign the bill. That's the inside baseball talk of reviewing a bill, even if they're inclined to sign it. So those that might be listening, that's kind of an inside baseball talk. So, Rick Tamgara.
Chair, with all due respect, Mr. Attorney General, nobody's talking about behind closed door stuff. I've never seen a governor go to the public and hold and have public hearings on what he's going to veto and what he's not going to veto. The governor does that in his office. So I want to put the behind closed doors thing to the side. The governor does that behind closed doors, and he's allowed to. The Constitution certainly allows the governor to tell the House and Senate to work it out and gives the governor 90 days to decide whether or not to veto. It allows the governor to do that, but it also allows the governor to get involved in the process now. There's no prohibition in the Constitution that would bar the governor from sitting down with the House and the Senate to try and work out something that works out in the best interest of the people of the state of Alaska. And I guess I would ask that you work with the governor to try and figure out which of these projects are the best ones to lower the cost of energy, extend stable energy to different parts of the state. And I think if everybody did that in good faith, and we had public hearings on these projects, so the public is involved too, I think everybody wins. But I don't see a way around the special session if the governor's going to say, I'm not going to tell you which projects I support, which ones I don't, and give me 90 days and I'll veto them. Because right now there's not a lot of trust between the Senate and the governor. And they have different reasons. They have different positions on why that is. So I'm still hoping that you would encourage the governor to do that. And the only other way, I mean, there are very few ways out of the special session without cooperation from all three parties now. And the governor, if he were to take the position, I'm not telling you anything, I'm going to wait my 90 days and then I'll tell you, he has the constitutional right to do that, but just because you have the right to do something doesn't mean that's the right thing to do.
I see the chair, as I indicated, I will certainly provide whatever assistance I can in the functioning of my responsibilities, and I believe dialogue is critically important. I would simply note that although the governor does have the right to 90 days to make a determination as to whether or not he's going to veto any project, he actually has to justify the basis for the veto. And once that is done, then the legislature has the prerogative and the power to override. And on top of that, the people have a say in the process as well. And that's a process that all are subject to. Thank you.
Representative Costello.
Okay, thank you, through the chair. Attorney General Burns, I'm really pleased to have you appear before the Finance Committee. I wanted to thank the co-chairs for inviting you. This morning we heard information about some of the energy projects that are linked together in the Senate capital budget version, that links all those projects together. But I don't see this as a discussion or a logjam about the specific energy projects. I think that what we're struggling with here is what you testified to, which is that all of these projects are linked. And, I'm a freshman legislator. I've taught high school government class, and I think that from that standpoint, there was something that didn't sit right with me when this bill came before us. I want to publicly thank the House leadership for continually coming back to the caucus and asking us repeatedly about this linkage of the projects. And clearly that is the issue that we are facing right now. It doesn't have anything to do with what those projects are. And we've heard this morning that many of them have we've seen before. Some are small, we haven't seen before. I think the concern, as you mentioned, is that in the future, in future legislative sessions, what will be linked then? Will it be transportation projects? Will it be education projects? And and there's something that you know, that doesn't sit well with me and also the members of the caucus. And so I did want to say that it's a communal voice that we are experiencing frustration over the linking of the project. And specifically, when I read through your memo regarding the constitutionality, you mentioned that the five-point test includes a provision that says that capital budget must not enact law or amend existing law. And I was wondering if you could comment on the state's energy policy that was recently passed and how you see this capital budget breaching into setting new law by virtue of linking these projects together and almost in a policy situation.
Briefly, I would certainly defer to my colleagues.
Yes, me, the Attorney General. I think you reach for a lifeline on this one.
The point of the confinement provision is that appropriations really need to be focused on appropriations, the amount of money and the item that's associated with. You can't substantively, through an appropriation process, create law, nor can you, in essence, further a policy as is being sought to do with 115, and that's the concern in this instance. I don't know if Ms. Bjorkqvist wants to add something further to that.
For the record, I am Brian Bjorkqvist. I'm a senior assistant attorney general for the state of Alaska, and I think I sat in on this morning's hearing, and it's quite obvious that there is not an energy plan per se. This is a work in progress. And there's a lot of work being done by a lot of different agencies to put it together, but there is not one state energy plan. The intent language in the bill for Section 4 references the statutory energy plan, and the language specifically referenced there speaks in terms of helping communities develop an energy for their communities to serve those communities, and that is better read as being helping individual communities advance as opposed to there being any linkage statewide, that the fact that an agency can help one community develop energy that is necessary for that community shouldn't be precluded because another community isn't getting that. Helping one community at a time certainly fulfills the language in the statutory state energy plan. Per se, but beyond that, I have not seen any place where there's a coherent, absolutely comprehensive energy plan where everything needs to be linked together.
Representative Costello.
In this morning's session, you heard Representative Darren mention that in the 9 years that he has served, there have been times where there was language addressing a line item. But when I read through your review, it seems like then in those instances, there was never a case where individual projects were linked. So could you clear that up for the committee?
Yes. There is, as the Knowles case clearly articulates, the legislature in legislating can set forth intent language. As long as the intent language does not constrain the constitutional prerogative of a governor to exercise the veto authority, because the intent is legislative language that the governor cannot, as Noel's case clearly articulates, language is not an item. And so the governor cannot line out any particular language, because if you think about it, lining out language is effectively legislating. And so language is on the right side, you know, items, appropriation items are the left, right, or however you want to characterize it. But the one does not depend on the other. And that's the requirement of separation. I would also, just as an aside note, that when you talk about the logical extension of what is being proposed by the Senate Finance, think about it in the context of the categories that fulfill the capital budget. Education, all right, transportation, health, So if we could link all of these together, you would have one health appropriation. You'd have one education appropriation. So a school in Fairbanks would be tied to a school in Anchorage, would be tied to a school in Tuntutuliak. You know, that's not appropriate way to administer the appropriations.
Thank you.
Okay, we have Representative Fairclough and Bryce in the queue, and I just want to put out to see if there's anybody in Juneau on the Finance Committee that wanted to get in the queue for questions.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Representative Dugan would like to be in the queue, please.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Wilson. Representative Fairclough.
I'm not an attorney, nor do I want to practice or try to be one today, but as Representative Costello said earlier, when you first saw the contingency language about 2 weeks ago now, right before we went into special session, I guess, it didn't sit well with me either. It felt like we were trying to strip the governor of his right to line item veto, and so the process is specifically what I have concerns with. I know that we're trying to get out of special session, and I support energy solutions that help benefit all of Alaska. But the reason I'm sitting here in this seat today in Anchorage, Alaska, and not in Juneau is I feel like we've had sound bites that have been being thrown around about the good and the bad and the ugly of the capital budget and who's right and who's wrong and just the blame game all the way around. And I really hope that and thank the co-chairs of Finance for allowing us to be here, because what I would like is a conversation around the policy choice that's before the Senate and maybe before the House should they transmit that capital budget to us. And that policy discussion about is it okay for a legislative body that even if the House and the Senate agree to link a group of projects that appear to be standalone projects that should be, in my humble opinion, subject independent of line item veto, is that right or is that wrong? And so that's sort of why I'm standing on a mountain, per se, with my flag saying, Alaskans, is this what you want from your legislative body? So, one, I'm trying to get away from the blame game because I'm not trying to blame the Senate, nor am I trying to defend that anyone's wrong. But for me, not a lawyer, not an attorney, it just doesn't sit right, and I don't know how to describe that in a soundbite that gets out to the people of Alaska on how important this issue and what it would mean if we didn't have the debate now. So my questions are a couple-fold. One, when we speak to the Senate, because we do speak to the Senate when we're in Juneau frequently, all of us, and we have many debates in the halls or in our offices about this language. In one of the debates on the House floor, and I believe in the hall one day with Will, there's other contingency language out there that has passed a constitutional muster inside the court system. So you spoke to it briefly under Representative Costello's question, but there is contingency language that has been supported in the court. So if you could have a conversation again on contingency language to tease out how contingency language can be okay. And non-severability clauses are in different bills. So if you could, again, speak to why in this instance, please help me support my debate in talking with Senate members, why I just can't swallow. I can't back away from this particular issue when you're taking all projects that are not on equal footing and placing them before us to vote yes or no. And I just think it's a wrong policy.
And to the chair, Representative, the last few words is really where it's at, the linking of all. Contingency language tied to a particular item, for example, the 150 fuel, my particular item, you know, then there's that, you know, that the theory being we don't have the money unless fuel prices get to 150. There's a nexus there. But to say that, you know, everything is tied together and one falls, they all fall, particularly as I understand was described this morning, that there is no nexus amongst these various projects. Many of them, you know, and presumably all of them have merit. But, you know, they are very distinctly separate projects. And to lump them all together is you know, not only, you know, inappropriate, but unconstitutional. And that's the dilemma. So, and then again, I would turn to my colleagues to add.
For the record, again, I am Brian Bjorka, Senior Assistant Attorney General, through the chair, Representative Faircloth. What I would add to that is going back to the basics. The Alaska Supreme Court defined an item of appropriation to be a sum of money dedicated to a particular purpose. The intent language under the Hammond test, which is, seems complicated, but it's really focused on that, is the language the minimum amount necessary to really explain what the legislature intends for that appropriation, describing the particular purpose for which the money is to be dedicated. And if the answer to that is yes, then you have a constitutional intent language or other types of language. Now, that could be a description of the how, what, why the monies are going to be appropriated or how they're going to be used and expended. As the Attorney General also mentioned, there could be contingencies tied to the receipt or non-receipt of other monies. Those types of connections between the actual appropriation, what it's intended for, are valid and under the confinement clause because there's a connection between the language and the appropriation itself. It's when you get beyond that that run into constitutional problems.
Ms. Percliff.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One of the conversations, again, I believe on the Senate floor was about a mousetrap and creating a new mousetrap and how that may be a good thing and some may say it's a bad thing. So when I refer to a new mousetrap, I'm talking about the linkage of all the energy projects with the contingency language and the severability, depending on how it is brought forward to us. So some are saying that regardless of what we do, we need the court to answer the question on the new mousetrap. If the legislative bodies, the House and the Senate, come together and decide to tell the governor that all of our projects need to be funded, period, that we're going to have to have a test before the Supreme Court to say yay or nay on pieces and components of this new mousetrap. Can you speak to why we should go forward and have that legal challenge done now, or why it might be, or is there a different route that we can find out whether this creative linkage can withstand a constitutional challenge?
And I have thought about the same thing, Representative. Faircloth, if someone told me something is poisonous or make me sick, I don't really feel the need to try to taste it to just check for sure. But Mr. Attorney General.
Thank you for the chair, Representative. The what was interesting, first of all, relative to the comments about a mousetrap, you will recall the comments to be a mousetrap for the purpose of constraining power. Right? So the point of this mousetrap is to pull away power. The only power that the legislature has, the only power that the governor has, and the only power that or responsibilities that the third branch, judiciary, has, are vested in the Constitution. And so when you're creating a mousetrap to take power away, you know, the basis for the mousetrap is, you know, is problematic. The We have thoroughly reviewed the language at Senate Finance, and you know, from our perspective, the Department of Law, the tying of so many projects, the clear intent for which the tying and the non-severability exists is for the purpose of depriving the governor of that line item veto power. So I think on its face, it's unconstitutional. However, there is no guarantee without, you know, having that tried in court. It would be a travesty in my mind to the state of Alaska as a whole if we were having to do something like that. You know, to the extent that the Senate Finance Committee desires to do that, and the Senate and the full legislature buy into that process, then that's the route that would be taken. I mean, in my mind, you know, as Representative Guerra indicated, you know, there ought to be a different way to do it. You know, the fact that we would you know, have the legislature and the governor, you know, the executive branch at odds, particularly at a time when we need to be building the state of Alaska, would be unfortunate.
Representative Fairclough. We have Representative Edgman and then Representative Dugan and Juneau.
Mr. Chairman, a couple of points, if I might. Attorney General, the language in Title 44 relating to the state energy policy is what we commonly know as intent language, which, of course, is non-binding, doesn't carry the force of the law. And I'll help you, I'll ask you to elaborate on this here in a moment, but to carry the force of the law that normal binding statutory language would carry. So my question is that doesn't the fact that we have, or what appears to be, intent language in the Senate's capital budget tying into existing intent language over in Alaska law, does that sort of play into the hands of the five factors in the confinement clause, or strengthens the argument that that in fact that you know, we may not that the legal challenge that would seek to uphold this argument would not be as strong because you instead of having a I see substantive law being quoted here under the Hammond factors where it says the minimum necessary to explain the appropriation. So just to close by saying what you appear to have here is intent language, and intent language tying into what would argue that it's substantive law. So, but does that undermine or does that strengthen the confinement clause's argument that you need to have the separation of powers?
Yeah, through the chair, Representative, intent language is intent language. I mean, it always will be. The concern is that where intent language tries to substantively create law in the context of an appropriation, you can have a bill that's you know, that lays out substantive law as 4499.115 tries to do. You do not do that through an appropriation. You know, I would defer to either Mr. Bjornquist or Mr. Poe for further comment relative to the intent language, and specifically 115.
And I would, again, I'm Brian Bjornquist, Senior Assistant Attorney General, through the Chair, Representative Edgeman. I think you have it correct, because this language in the statute doesn't really create a program. It's just direction, goals, et cetera, that the state is striving for. There is not an energy plan in existence today, and the language in the Senate proposed bill, it really is trying to create or call itself an energy plan by grouping a whole bunch of appropriations for energy projects together, calling itself an energy plan and trying to use that as an excuse for linking projects together. And if that is, in fact, what it's doing, then it's creating substantive law by creating an energy plan through that linkage of all these programs together, which is one of the Hammond factors. It's why it's a violation of the confinement clause of the Constitution, because it's enacting substantive law, substantive provisions in an appropriation bill. And not only that, it's not only creating the program, but it's also trying to control the program by dictating where the money gets spent. It's administering the program at the same time.
Mr. Chairman, just to follow up on a separate point, and just to say, as a rural legislator, certainly the budgets that we pass each session are very critical to, you know, all the state, but certainly as well as a rural Alaska, and I couldn't argue more about the impact of the capital budget for rural Alaska. But this whole discussion that we've had thus far sort of presumes the fact that we have to leave the legislative session with the capital budget, when in fact, constitutionally, we do not. Isn't that correct?
That is correct.
That was Attorney General Burton's protocol. That we have Representative Dugan in Juneau.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair. I just want to let you know that Representative Guttenberg has been with us for a while, and he would like to be added to the queue, please.
He's right after Representative Dugan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Attorney General, I think I've got a couple of what I hope are quick questions here. In your testimony, well, excuse me, your press conference a couple days ago and in your testimony today, you raised the specter of some third party coming in and invalidating some or all of the budget. It's not clear exactly what the target would be. If the bill was written in the way that the Senate is trying to write this bill, can you tell me if that's ever happened?
My understanding, through the chair of representative, my understanding that this is the first time in history that this is this approach is being pursued. So I'm unaware of any such instance.
Let me ask
you. I would direct your attention to Section 37, the language of Section 37 itself. It talks about notwithstanding 01-10-030, which is the standard severability language in the statute, if the contingency found in Section 36 of this Act is held to be invalid, then the contingency is not severable from the appropriations made in Section 4 of the Act. So if the language of 36 is invalid, meaning that if what is sought to be achieved is the unconstitutional usurpation of, you know, the executive branch's power, then it all fails. That tie-in of the non-severability is really what creates tremendous exposure to these projects, all of the projects, because anybody, a public interest litigant, whomever, could challenge that provision of Section 36. And if that provision of Section 36 is held to be invalid, then 37 says everything is imploded.
Thank you, Mr. Attorney General. I think I understood that the first three times you told me. What I was asking was, has there ever been a case in which this happened to an appropriation in the state of Alaska?
Through the chair, Representative, I apologize. I thought I had to answer that initially when I said I was unaware of any such instance.
Thank you very much. Mr. Chairman, one other question. Thank you. The example that we're using is a little, I'm having a little trouble understanding that. So let me try it like this. If we were to do an appropriation for VPSOs, and not specify specifically which VPSOs we wanted, or maybe we would. Let's assume that we did. We specified we got 10 of them, this is where they're going to be stationed. Does that violate the governor's authority in any way?
To the chair, defer to Chris Pogue.
Through the chair, Representative Dugan, let me try and touch base on your last question to the Attorney General. I can't think of an instance specifically where there was a challenge to a contingency that links together numerous appropriation items, but I am familiar with there are legal challenges where public interest litigants, individuals challenge appropriations as a violation of the dedication clause. For example, we had there was a recent case regarding the Alaska Land Trust, and there was also not too long ago a challenge regarding tobacco bombs. So we have had litigation regarding appropriations as being in violation of the dedication clause. So similarly, I imagine that a public interest litigant or any litigant could bring a challenge alleging that the constitutional process is being violated by the executive and legislative branch, and they wish to see the appropriation process righted. And going back a little bit we've talked a lot about the confinement clause, and that's one of the restraints on appropriations bills. It limits appropriations bills to appropriations. But the real problem with this linkage is that what we're doing is we're combining numerous appropriation items and eliminating the governor's authority, clear black and white authority in the Constitution, that he gets to eliminate, reduce, or strike appropriation items. So what we're talking about is a legislative infringement of the constitutional authority in black and white that's been assigned to the governor. So as much as we fuss and struggle with contingencies, they are difficult. The test is not easy. This is one of those cases that's very clear. The language of the Constitution gives the governor the authority to strike appropriation items. Section 36 links numerous items and eliminates his authority to remove or reduce some of those items. It's very clear. And I respect the opinion of Les Legal, but they were clear that this could go either way. As a lawyer, I deal with shades of gray every day. This is a fairly clear case. The constitutional language is plain. If the legislature wants the authority, if it wants the authority to link appropriation items, the only way to do that is to amend the Constitution.
That's we asked that question to some of our Senate colleagues, and they kind of scoffed at that.
And moving back to Representative Dugan's second question, I'm not quite sure I understand it, but we're sort of going back to the issue of what contingencies are allowed and what aren't, and hypotheticals. But there's some clear language in Legislative Council versus Knowles, too, that indicates there are important and appropriate restrictions. For example, which building ought to be funded, which building ought not to be funded. Should an appropriation be contingent on the conditioning of a certain event, like federal receipts being received? But as we get further afield from what is clearly the constitutional goal of having appropriation items being limited to a sum and a purpose, it gets grayer and grayer. And so that's why the Hammond test is multifactored, and the court says it's not exclusive. It reserved for another day the opportunity to maybe bring forward another test. So if I understand his position, so long as it was just BPSOs in a certain location, that would seem to be appropriate. But I need to give an important warning. That was what happened in the ASME appropriation. It said, we want to fund ASME employees so long as they're not above range 21, and if they're above range 21, they need to be inside the state of Alaska. The court called that a local mini-hire law, and it said that's beyond the confinement clause, and so it was an attempt to legislate an appropriation bill. So it appears from Representative Dugan's questions that he's not trying to declare where BPSOs ought to be located, but just where this funding for this appropriation ought to be located. And on the face, it seems appropriate, but I'm dealing with sort of limited facts.
Did you have any other questions, Representative Dugan?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm not. I should have known better than to try to get lawyers to answer a simple question for me. I apologize. Thank you.
Well, I'll leave my comments off the table. I just want to just follow up on that before we get Representative Guttenberg. I just remember you and I have talked in developing the budget for your department, my capacity as chairman of the Department of Law. It really is the trend of groups opposing development in Alaska. That's it. I know we had lengthy litigation on the Alpine Field, the North Star development, that we delayed those projects. There are groups in Alaska that have a bent against moving forward on development projects, and that's their agenda. Certainly, I would be very surprised if there wasn't litigation against the Susitna appropriation. I'd be very surprised if somebody didn't litigate against the potentially billion-dollar project that's located in the Wiktik State Park. I mean, those are all just things that just seem to jump out at me as possibilities. We have folks that are trying to shut down even the potential of oil exploration in Alaska through litigation and going through administrative policy. So this seems to be a pretty easy one to imagine whether it be litigation. Am I speculating too wildly, Mr. Attorney General?
No, absolutely. Yeah. More importantly, though, the scope of potential litigants could include, regardless of whether your philosophical bent as to development of natural resources.
It could be a group, citizens of conservative groups, citizens against government waste.
Or it could be somebody simply concerned that the state of Alaska follow the constitutional mandates. It could be anybody who, feels that the constraints of Section 36 are inappropriate.
Mr. Attorney General, there was the Senate has suggested they'd have language that would limit third-party litigants. And, I'm a little mixed reaction on that. I've been pushing for tort reform for years. If they've got this little inspiration over there that there's a way to fix that through a budget bill, well, maybe we've been wasting too much time trying to get hearings in judiciary committees.
Through the chair, that also would cause me some constraints because I'm not sure that would not violate the Constitution if all of a sudden you're trying to constrain people from asserting their constitutional rights to ensure that the Constitution is being followed. It's a high hypothetical question. I'm not.
I'm told it can be fixed, but that's. I don't have a bill in my hand, Mr. Attorney General, so I'm kind of limited on just speculation.
Yeah, I would be concerned on limiting anybody's ability to challenge the unconstitutionality.
I am a tort reformer. I'm a little mixed emotions on this, but I think I'd rather do it through statutory change, going through the necessary court rule changes and everything else. I'm a process guy. So, Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I heard some comments earlier about state energy policy from your office, Mr. Attorney General, and I'd like to say, 4499115 Declaration of State Energy Policy is out there. That is those are broad policies. Ms. Fisher Goh's predecessor, Steve Hagenson, put a lot of effort into refining that into. I thought it was a pretty succinct document, and I'm concerned that you're telling us that the legislature between the House and the Senate, if we come up with a plan to implement that in a way that is that would be satisfactory to both the House and the Senate and every member, that the governor could decide through his veto power to upset the cart. And I know your answer will be to, that the legislature at that time could come back and exercise its veto override authority. But in that case, why wouldn't the legislature and why wouldn't it be constitutional for the legislature to write that as one single sentence?
Mr. Attorney General, or your designee?
Through the chair, I am Brian Bjorkla, Senior Assistant Attorney General. My comments with respect to the statutory declaration of the state energy policy is that that legislation is a statement of goals and goals that the state agencies and the state is striving for. It is not per se a program from which you could look at the appropriations made in Section 4 and say that it is implementing an established program. If the appropriations in Section 4 are a program of the state energy plan, it is being created itself in the context of appropriating, making the appropriations for the various projects. The state energy policy doesn't have a mechanism or a process that fits into the appropriations made in Section 4. That's what I tried to say earlier.
If I may follow up, thank you, with a couple of questions. But isn't the policy what the legislature says it is? If the legislature passes this list of projects, then that's the energy policy being implemented by the state. And then it's the governor's responsibility to carry it out. To say that there's something else that we're not following up on, that there's not another written document, is, I think, off the point. The point is that what the legislature says the policy is, after it passes the law and hands it to the governor, then that's what the policy is, isn't it? Or is it something else that we don't know about?
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, this is getting back to the issue of the Constitution and appropriation bills. Appropriation bills must be limited to appropriations. It cannot include substantive law. If the legislature wants to adopt a policy, an energy policy, an energy plan, it has to do so in substantive law and enact substantive law. That's what the legislature did with 4499.115, and it speaks for itself. It's a piece of substantive law. The legislature could not enact this policy or any other policy in the context of appropriation bills, because appropriation bills under the confinement clause must be limited to appropriations. And so to enact a policy, it would have to be done in substantive law.
So if I may follow through, so could you tell me what in the Senate version of this bill is outside of 115? I mean, what violates 115?
Mr. Bjornquist.
Representative Guttenberg, The comments about what is in the Senate version of the bill have to do with what the Senate is attempting to do, or what that bill is attempting to do, linking all of the projects together and calling all of the linkage of all of those projects together a state energy plan or the state energy policy, or however they're trying to characterize it to justify the linkage of a large number of energy projects. Everything in that bill may have something touching on something in this because of, they're striving for the goals, et cetera, but it isn't implementing a program that's established in this particular piece of legislation, because this particular piece of legislation doesn't create a plan itself or a program itself. It just provides some goals and aspirations for the state to strive for.
Just one more thing, Mr. Chair, if I may. So at the end of the day, the legislature has to do the entire thing at one time or not at all, and that we can't go forward in implementing it in parts. That's all for that. Just one more question, if I may. I've heard the general constantly say something's constitutional, not constitutional. Isn't that the job of the courts and just an opinion from you, Mr. Burns? I mean, I'm concerned you're saying those things as if they're a matter of law. They're just a matter of opinion. And we have dueling opinions on the table.
It does have the force of law as opposed to other legislative opinions. But Mr. Burns.
Through the chair, Representative Gutenberg, it is the opinion of the Department of Law. You're absolutely right from the standpoint that I do not, I'm not a member of the judiciary. The body of attorneys that comprise the Department of Law evaluate the cases, evaluate the situations in the context of the present law, the case law, and the like. As Mr. Pogue indicated, this is not, in our opinion, a close case. It may be novel, but what's clearly being attempted here is to link 105 separate and distinct projects into one appropriation and to say that they are all fall within the penumbra of energy. And again, where does it stop? That's the problem that potentially exists here, is that you can look at every department of transportation project is tied to one another. Every school project is tied to one another. Every health related issues tied to one another. That's why there is a clear requirement of a demarcation between an item and an appropriation, not a topic, which is where we're starting to go in this regard. And if I would just, in response to the earlier question, Representative Gutenberg, the criteria set forth in the Hammond case, the five factors. All of those criteria are evaluated, and so to the extent that there's a violation of those criteria, whether it be all or some of them, it still then runs afoul of the confinement provision. And I would note, two in particular, right off the bat, is the direct attempt to control how monies are spent on energy projects is an attempt to administer the program of expenditures. The other thing is that linking appropriations, as I noted, to 105 different projects is not the appropriation, not germane to the item. What you've got is a category. And again, I would just emphasize, where do you draw the line? If 105 today, how many tomorrow?
Thank you,
Mr.
Chair.
It's about the process. It's about following the Constitution.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My point was that is the opinion of the Attorney General. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Vera.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm starting.
Thank you. Representative Vera.
Sorry. I'm starting to develop all the facts I need to have a summer long of nightmares, and that is that every week we're gonna have you saying that this is unconstitutional, and the Senate holding hearings with legislative legal saying it's likely constitutional. And it's just not going to get us anywhere. It will give me nightmares, but it's not going to get us anywhere. And as a former assistant attorney general, I respect the work that you do. I think that the folks that work in that office do very good work. I've worked with Brian before. You said something before that concerned me. It was in response to one of Representative Edgman's questions. And I understand that the Constitution allows us to leave UNO without doing a capital budget, but just because it allows us to do that doesn't mean that that's the right thing to do. And I hope folks will do everything they can to do what I said before, which is work together collaboratively now so we can have a capital budget. The price of energy across the state is way too high. A lot of these projects in this budget item, and it's getting lost in this debate, are good projects that will save consumers money. Some of them may be debatable, but if we leave the legislature with no energy package and no weatherization money so that people can upgrade the energy efficiency of their homes, I think that's going to be a bad thing. So I know we can leave the legislature without a capital budget, but I'm hoping that you'll advocate to the governor that we do everything we can to work together so we leave the capital with a capital budget, at least with an energy plan.
Thank you. Well, I'd just like to interject. It's really hard to pass a capital budget if it doesn't leave one body to the other. It's a bicameral process, and I know what. Harping on that, but that's another pesky part of the Constitution, and it's just a really hanging point for me that I just don't like the idea of somebody saying take everything we have word for word with that constitutionally questionable provisions. Sometimes you just don't, I'll just leave it at that. We have a bicameral process, and there's this. I don't like to point back at the governor because he doesn't have an input until a bill passes. So. Bicameral, two bodies, House and Senate. That seems to get lost in a lot of the debate, not from you, Representative Guerra, but necessarily, but from a lot of others that don't recognize that there is a House of Representatives that has to not just pass a bill, but first receive a bill. And it's a pretty clearly delineated process of how this works. And anyway, two bodies have to agree before you're in a position to work with the governor to recommend action. Questions from the other questions for the Attorney General?
Just a comment through the Chair, Representative Guerra. I would also, as an Alaskan, share a concern that there be a capital budget. Notwithstanding my position as Attorney General, I am an Alaskan, and I know the importance of the capital budget. It is a process, and we just want to make certain that the process is pursued appropriately. And just to clarify, Mr. Chairman, if I misspoke in response to Representative Gutenberg's question, I am an attorney, and from the standpoint of the comments that I've made, they are the opinion of the Department of Law and myself, and truly they are just an opinion. Ultimately, to the extent that this has not been tried in the past, the ultimate determination would be made by the judiciary. As often is the case, when you have multiple attorneys, there are competing opinions. We have evaluated it very carefully, and as you are well aware, we've had many very intelligent individuals from the Department of Law evaluating it, and it's the consensus of the Department of Law that what appears in the Senate Finance language is unconstitutional, in our opinion.
I just took it as a little bit of interior rivalry. I didn't insult you, but one fair bit of guy fairly swatted another. But, Representative Guerra.
Thank you. And I meant to say this before. Attorney General Burns essentially said, I wish when I was litigating the Exxon case as an assistant attorney general that what I said had the force of law, but what the attorney general says does not have the force of law. What the courts say has it, what the statutes say has it, what regulations say has it, what Attorney General Burns says is an opinion, just like what we get from legislative legal. And not to be insulting, but I think I'm correct about that.
Absolutely. I concur 100% with what you just said.
Are there any other questions for the Attorney General or his team? Any last-minute wrap-up? Mr. Polk.
I apologize, Representative Schultz, but I think if we leave with a parting message, and I think the Attorney General pointed this out, if the legislature wants the mousetrap, the tying together of appropriation items to be tested by the courts, let's do that. But leave in 36 and take out Section 37. 37 ties all of these together and puts in a cloud over all of them. If you remove 37 and the governor, there's about 30 appropriation items. If he vetoed one or two of those, the rest could go forward while we fight in court about whether or not it's appropriate to tie together contingency or appropriation items. But if you put the severability provision in there, they're all going to be tied up until the court battle is resolved. And we're not looking for this fight, but I would encourage everybody who's been talking about Section 36 to just read the two or three sentences that are contained in Article 2, Section 15. They're in black and white, and they're pretty clear. And the governor gets to line item veto appropriation items. There are 30 appropriation items combined together by Section 36. Maybe there's a legal battle there, but it's pretty straightforward, in my opinion.
And we're not in a position to remove the language, because as it's been our intent of my caucus that we don't favor it. We're not actually in possession of bills. We stated at the beginning of the hearings this morning and again today, we're not in possession of Senate Bill 46. We're just having the discussion about the one referenced Section 4 and the contingency language and the non-severability language, so which I think we've clearly said from my caucus that we don't favor. Representative Fairclough and then Jewell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the recommendations from the Attorney General's office on striking one portion of the clause should we ever receive the capital budget. But again, my position is not to say yay or nay on what the Senate wants to move forward is good policy for Alaska, at least when we don't have the bill. But should the bill come over, both sections are unacceptable to me. It's standing up for Alaskans. And again, just restating that the governor constitutionally is provided the right to either reduce or redline a particular project. And they have the resources different than the legislative body. Your legislature, as Alaskans, sit for 90 days. We run $5 to $10 billion through our process, at least on the operating side, in about 45 days. I don't think that that's long enough to do an adequate review. That's just a personal opinion. I'm not asking for longer. I'm just saying that that's why we have a large budget today, because we just keep adding onto the top and we never dig down below the surface to find out if the money that's being spent is spent how Alaskans want it to be spent today. It's a cumulative effort of all 26 legislatures before me that have established priorities, and we have no idea or a very limited idea on whether that still meets the needs in a cohesive way today. So I appreciate the recommendation. Certainly it's been spoken to today that in negotiations, compromise is required. Mr. Chairman, members who are sitting here today listening to us, I'm happy to compromise if I had a piece of skin in the game. But the House Finance and the House of Representatives have not seen a bill transmitted that we have any kind of certainty as to what the Senate is even proposing as good policy for the state of Alaska. For those in the interior, I have got to think that the Senate's going to add some more money in, because I can't believe in a system that we have today that the Senate would say it is good policy to leave $100 million on the table and not fund the Tanana Bridge project. I'm not saying any of the projects are good, bad, or otherwise in this. I cannot believe an interior delegation would not fight for $100 million available to us federally and then present us a budget that's almost $3 billion without that $100 million in it. And that's just one issue that I know that they have to go back and address. And so what I'm trying to say, Mr. Chairman, is I know that the Senate will continue to work on the budget and do what's right for Alaskans. And until that is passed to us, it's hard for us to put an imprint of what the House sees as the gaps in funding or even speak to the language, because we know if you change the word and to or, the whole context of what we're reading means something totally different. So, you know, people try to get me to sign on or be for or against something, you know, all the way through the beginning of a process, but this process can't continue until we actually have a capital budget in our chambers to actually see if there's an and or an or that makes something that we have a poison pill. And, I really appreciate those who are trying to reach compromise, but from my perspective, we have nothing to compromise if we have nothing in the capital budget. And so, Mr. Chairman, I don't want to belabor it. I really, really would implore the press and those that are talking about this issue to dig deep about the policy issue that's in front of the legislature right now. Maybe it is a really unique, very creative mousetrap, but is it something that would fit all governors and all legislatures? And really, do we really want to move forward that we can link hundreds of projects together and commit hundreds of millions of dollars that could be on the table or off the table with one stroke of a pen? I just think that's bad public policy, and I'm not trying to be obstinate, Mr. Chairman, as a single legislator, as representing one district. I don't think it matters who's in the governor's office. I hope I would be just as passionate, no matter who it was, if we were trying to take things that are dissimilar and we try to link them together because we want them passed without the appropriate constitutional measure put before it and after it. So I appreciate the latitude, Mr. Chairman, and I thank the committee for listening.
I remember a cartoon, The Wizard of Id, and I think Sir Rodney ran to the king and told him that somebody had invented a better mousetrap. You know what that meant? He said, well, somebody must have invented a better mouse. And I'm not sure. I think this mouse has been created. Maybe it's a rabbit rat or something. I don't know. But I'm not assuming we need to have a better mousetrap until we know what kind of rodents are out there. But Representative Jewell. I hope I didn't go too far there.
Neither about the mouse or the mouse trap,
Mr. Chairman.
However, about the cat. No. I'll just keep my remarks really short. It's not a question. It's going to seem kind of bland, I guess, at this point. But the necessity of a capital budget for our state is really important. If it's a project in rural Alaska, the importance is to people who might get work, to a service or a school that might be provided in a better way, and to Anchorage because of the material, or Seattle because the material is purchased here, and the jobs that provides to everybody, irregardless of where you live. And those capital projects become a way of getting people through a training process and ultimately to work so that they can feel good about who they are. It's one of those things where we said during the course of the legislature that the best form of welfare is a job. And so many of these projects are tied to just that, especially as they relate to some of the folks that I represent in the rural areas. So I guess the bland thing that I'm talking about is that I hope this can get resolved before we lose yet another season, a season to ship material so that things can get done at the end of the day. And with that, I appreciate your the information that you've given us. It's certainly a lot of us to think, a lot to think about and understand, you know, the points that you make. And I try to take a look at things from a balanced view, kind of like playing horseshoes, I guess. So thank you, Mr. Chairman, for bringing us up here so that we can kind of, from outside of Juneau, kind of get a little bit different feel of what's going on with these projects, but also with regards to the constitutionality of the language that's embedded in these bills. Thank you.
And I'd like to note to the public, as much as we'd like to stay here for the weekend and visit our family and friends, we're all heading back early in the morning. So it's almost like a tease getting home for a day and then turning right back around. So it's, I appreciate the members coming and bringing this this presentation to the a broader scope of the people of Alaska. And you'll have the closing word, Mr. Attorney General.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I also remained very hopeful that after further review, the contingency, both the contingency and non-severability language will be removed from whatever capital budget is forwarded from the Senate to the House and ultimately to the governor. It is my understanding that the governor, some of this apparently was precipitated by concerns as to whether and how the governor would exercise his constitutional prerogative. It is my understanding that the governor has unequivocally asserted that he will evaluate each project on the merits of the project, that he will not exercise a veto based on how someone may or may not have voted in the past, that each of these projects will be vetted and evaluated on the merits of each case, which is the responsibility of the governor in exercising his powers and his position of office. He has, as I noted, the responsibility to articulate the reason for any action to the extent that he vetoes it. Ultimately, this legislature has the veto override, and that is the checks and balances. And I would reiterate the comments made by Representative Herkloff in asserting that it really is about a process. It is about doing things consistently with the Constitution. And from that perspective, I would hope that we are not in the midst of a legal fray, but that the non-severability and the contingency language is removed, and that the process of appropriation evaluation plays out as it should and has historically done so. Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you, and thank you for your team here. Just wanted to thank the three senators that were. We've had several senators come through, but Senator McGuire has joined Senator Olson and Senator Giesel. I think Senator Giesel has been here continuously, as Senator Olson has almost. And I'd also like to thank a mayor from just outside of my political jurisdiction, Mayor Delana Johnson, who has sat through this. In her discussions with me, there have not been discussions about individual capital projects, but just about process. And it's been one of the most refreshing point of views I've heard from local government, and I'm really privileged to be in the sphere of that of Mayor Johnson, Mayor Delaney Johnson. Thank you. With that, we will reconvene in Juneau, hopefully with some something to take up on Saturday, time to be announced. Assume it'll be a call of the chair, waiting to see if we have a bill or potential movement. So with that, we're adjourned until Saturday in Juneau.